welcome along. Thank you to the Patreons for your continued support. Thank you to everybody who listens to the podcast as well. We have a special guest with us, a friend of the podcast. Colin Miller has joined us. Now, Colin, you will remember, long-term listeners will remember, Colin's book here, The Frying Pan of Spain, which is still available online, I'm sure, Colin. A stable mate of mine, by the way, that's still by list. you can pick those up for about £3, I think, on Amazon now. So, crack on. So, yes, so the Frying Pan of Spain is Colin's book. It's been out a while now about the city of Seville, the rivalry between Sevilla and Betis. But Colin is now with the Mirror as the European football writer. And you can tell he's gone up in the world, Terry, because he asked me for a running order for the podcast. That's the running order, isn't it? obviously, Terry is here. So what we're going to do, we're going to have a quick look back on the season, really straightforward. And then, well, it's not straightforward, but then we're going to look forward to some of the summer transfer madness. It's almost reassuring when football goes crazy again, isn't it? Because it means that the world is getting somewhere back to normal if football is crazy and there's been a lot of business going on. We can't, because we're recording this before the Segunda playoff final. We still don't actually know who is in La Liga next season, which is incredible, isn't it? When you think that other teams are back on their, you know, back after pre-season, getting ready for the next season. We don't know where we're standing. So, Colin, tell us about your new job. So, how much is La Liga? Where does the Mirror sort of put its priority in terms of following its European leagues?
Yeah, essentially, it's one of those things that when I came on, I went to the Mirror a year ago, and it was part of their coverage to sort of ramp up European football coverage. And obviously, a lot of like every English media site, it's always going to be very Premier League dominated, and they wanted to expand out a little bit more and to cover the clubs a little bit more, to cover the issues a little bit more. So when there are these big stories, and especially around, obviously, Real Madrid and Barcelona, especially with the finances of Barcelona and everything else that's tied up there, to have a little bit more of an insight, and maybe to have a little bit more of an understanding just beyond the actual story itself, to have a little bit more of an explainer. So essentially my role is to cover that, and obviously with my background, particularly in Spanish football, would be to prioritise those sorts of clubs and those sorts of stories. But of course, whatever happened last summer with Messi joining PSG, and then all of a sudden PSG and Liga is all of a sudden a big deal for a lot of people who might not naturally have followed it. And then obviously you've got the other top leagues as well. So essentially it's a wide ranging role, but with my background in Spain and Spanish football, a lot of it is sort of covering the media and monitoring the media there, and then just to sort of give it a greater insight too. So from my point of view, it's almost like a dream job, I suppose, is to sort of shed a bit more light on that, and hopefully bring out a little bit more insight to people. And it's great, I think, as well for more media outlets here to be doing that and to be driving coverage towards those leagues. Because as we all know, I mean, you know, we're huge fans of the leagues, but in terms of the general football fan in the UK, how much do they know about Spanish football, about French football, German, whatever else? I mean, maybe outside of the very, very top clubs, there's probably very little. And even then, we see the Champions League, and it's not even on free-to-air TV anymore. So how many people are even watching those matches on a regular basis? So that's the sort of thing. It's encouraging to see that maybe the trend is starting to reverse a little bit. Hopefully get more people interested in just what's going on abroad.
It's interesting, isn't it? I can't quite decide where we are with Spanish football at the moment, because in some ways people are more knowledgeable than ever. But obviously, it's not on Sky anymore. And as you say, it's a massive thing. You know, the latter stages of the Champions League, which were brilliant, you know, that Real Madrid run to win that competition was absolutely amazing. The fact that in the UK, you couldn't watch that unless you paid extra to BT, I thought was such a shame compared to how the old days were, you know, when there was always a game on ITV and all of that. So the danger is, certainly with Spanish football, is people's views seem to get a bit stuck where they were, you know, when they last watched it 2 or 3 years ago. And it's like, well, the classic one is with the Italian football, isn't it? Where people, oh, it's defensive, the Italian football. Literally, absolutely not the case. Hasn't been for, you know, I think they were outscoring the Bundesliga goal for goal the season before last.
Yeah.
But people just get a bit stuck, don't they, in their views. And the danger is that we just end up talking to a very small hardcore of people.
And that's the thing as well. You mentioned Italian footballer and the sort of preconceptions of it. I think a lot of that's true of Spanish football as well, whereby people will remember Pep Guardiola's Barcelona, of course, and think that almost every Spanish team is like a version of that in some way, whereby it's all this sort of tiki-taka football, and you know, these teams aren't physical, they're not aggressive. And when I'm watching La Liga matches now, I kind of think there's almost more of that in La Liga than there is in the Premier League. I remember a year ago whenever Varane signed for Man United, I can't remember who it was, but you know, he's going to have to deal with more crosses into the box now, and he's maybe not going to be used to that in space. And I actually, I looked at the stats about how many crosses Real Madrid faced compared to United, and Real Madrid had actually faced more. So Spanish sides were playing more width. They were playing that a more sort of direct, aggressive style of football than even is now in the Premier League. And I think maybe that's partly because the Premier League has changed. It's become, maybe has more continental influences than it has before through coaches. But also La Liga has changed as well. And I think it is hard to define La Liga because you still have that build-up from the back. You know, you still have all these teams who like to have this goalkeeper who's very comfortable with his feet and playing out from that from deep and building attacks from deep. But at the same time, you do have that physical aggression. And if you look at teams like Getafe, obviously him from Bordalas' time, and Valencia last season, I mean, these are teams that had more yellow cards than anybody else in top five leagues in Europe, more fouls than anybody else in top five leagues in Europe. And that I think is something in Spanish football now. And I mean, in a way, you could argue that's a good thing. And in a way, you could argue that's maybe not quite as good to watch as the other styles would be. But I think it does underline your point of just how many people who aren't regularly watching this, and you can understand why, just have that slight misconception of what they thought a team from Spain would play like.
And people still call it a two-team league. And neither of those two teams won it last season. And we had Villarreal in the Champions League semi-final, and there's a lot of good teams in La Liga, and the people still think it's the days when Pellegrini was manager and he got 99 points, I think it was, and finished second to Real Madrid, who got finished second to Barcelona, who got a couple more. That's when it was a two-team league, but it hasn't been for some while. And as Colin says, and you say, John, that people are stuck in their realizations of what La Liga is, and there's some really good teams. The mid-ranking teams have got better. The lower-ranked teams, there's still always a poor team or two in La Liga. Of course, there is, like any other league, but it does. That's the one criticism that annoys me, because people just haven't looked or haven't been told. So the more people like Colin spreading the word and giving them the truth and giving the right narrative, as opposed to a two-team league. I mean, Sevilla are not part. They're part of that top teams that are challenging for league titles. Now they haven't won one, and they should possibly be doing a bit better, but it's definitely not a two-team league. That's the one that it really irritates me. That and the training ground sale from Real Madrid that people have been banging on about recently. It was like 20-odd years ago under a whole different regime in La Liga that were running Spanish football, and where Real Madrid and Barcelona were encouraged for it to be a two-team league, where they were the only two that got any money from television, or they got 80% of it between them, something ridiculous, and the other 18 teams spread out a 20% share. A lot has changed, but that Real Madrid training ground one keeps coming back up because of Tebas complaining about PSG. I'm thinking that's not a legitimate excuse to blame Tebas for bleating. He was nowhere near Real Madrid then.
I've got some stats on that. Actually, I haven't got them handy, but a guy who I know called Dave Carberry, works for University of Bath, who's a very intelligent man, did a big analysis of where your points, where teams were in the league when they played each other, and who won, who got the points, how the scores went. And La Liga, in that respect, is the most competitive of the leagues that he looked at. So basically, from 1 to 20. So can team 19 beat team 3, et cetera? Obviously, team 3 was Atletico, so very much. So the whole anyone can beat anyone in the Premier League thing, obviously, literally, it's true, but it's not usefully true, because in reality, the top teams are more dominant. So the only one that was more top team dominant was the Bundesliga, which comes as no surprise and is an obvious. There's many good things about German football. The obvious problem is that lack of competitiveness, isn't it? That Bayern Munich have won the league 10 years in a row. So La Liga was the most competitive, probably helped this season by Atleti being disastrous against the bottom clubs. That probably swung it a bit. But the thing that we missed, Colin, I think, was a title race, wasn't it? Real Madrid were too good for the rest this season, weren't they?
Yeah, this was a season. It's an odd season because I don't think anybody was saying Real Madrid were particularly great, even when they were so far out in front in La Liga. You always thought there's this vulnerability about them. They don't dominate games. You know, they're not like Pep City. They're not like Klopp's Liverpool. They don't really have that sort of defined identity as to this elite team. But they became so relentless in La Liga, and that was always a criticism, wasn't it, of Ancelotti? That he's this guy who wins all these cup competitions, but in terms of winning every week in the league, he just never really had that where other top coaches did. But this year was entirely different, and they won. I wouldn't say they won ugly a lot, but they won without playing particularly well, and they just sort of kept doing that. And then when you got to the Champions League knockout, it was like, yeah, this is it. You know, this is going to be the final. They play PSG will beat them. You know, they play Chelsea. You know, it'll be like last year. Chelsea will beat them again, and then City and Liverpool. I mean, the teams that they beat to win that Champions League were arguably the four best teams in Europe. You can make an argument that they could not theoretically have had a tougher run than that to win the competition, yet they did. So that shows you a lot about what Real Madrid are and what Real Madrid were this season. And they were they had a stroke of luck, I suppose, in not having player injuries. I think had you have had Benzema maybe missing for a couple of weeks, that would have taken a toll. And you saw that in the second El Clasico of the season, whenever Ancelotti tried this sort of strange system against Barcelona, and it just didn't work at all. There was no Benzema up front. They didn't have that focal point, and they were outclassed. So it would be interesting to see, had that have taken effect, would we have had a title race? But I think it's a really good point that Terry made about the competitiveness in the league, because I was looking at the stats from 2019, 9 different clubs have won a trophy. Obviously, Villarreal and Sevilla have done that in terms of the Europa League, and a lot of other clubs have done that domestically. Now, 9 clubs in one division winning at least one trophy in the space of just over 3 years. I mean, that's remarkable. You don't get that in other top leagues. I think there's clubs who, even when they're in a bit of a downturn, like if you look at Villarreal this season, I mean, Villarreal have had two pretty, I would say, underwhelming domestic campaigns. They win the Europa League and then they get to the Champions League semi-finals. Even domestically, you look at Valencia getting within a couple of penalty kicks of lifting Copa del Rey, despite being in a mess in terms of their sort of structure and off the field and a lot of fan discontent. Underneath all of that, there's this culture whereby clubs can win. And it's hard to define that and hard to describe that. And then you're talking about the sort of within La Liga itself. If you look at the 3 teams that went down this season, any of them could have really stayed up until the final couple of weeks. Remember, it was only like 3 or 4 points separating that cluster of teams going into the running. And yet, Levante going down, and they'd struggled all season, but they had always given the top teams a great match. Obviously, they won away at Atletico this season. They had that 3-3 against Real Madrid. Wasn't it 4-3? They lost at home to Barcelona. This was a team who probably went against what a lot of La Liga teams are like these days, whereby they're very fun to watch. They were just a fun team because they went for the big teams. They didn't hold back. They just played this sort of fast, direct style of football. And yes, they took risks. And I think, yeah, they're going to be a lot to La Liga, but they were such a fun team to have in the league. And they were representative of a lot of those smaller clubs who could get results against the top 4 and top 5 teams. And that's been a trademark, I think, of La Liga, is that fact that you don't have any teams that are of a particularly low standard at any one time. But maybe the reverse of that is that obviously the very top level has fallen away a little bit, whereby you look at Barcelona finishing second, who had a relatively poor campaign, Atletico Madrid finishing third. Yeah, their title defense was a disaster. It was a disaster from the start. And it's the fact that those teams had such poor starts to the campaign almost normalized it for people watching, for us. But at the same time, you look back at their seasons and they were just so far off the pace, and to finish without any trophies, to finish so far behind Real Madrid. I mean, they had really poor seasons, yet they still managed. You still had those top earning clubs finishing in the top 4. So it was almost like that sense of normality. But at the same time, this was a league whereby you didn't know the results 1 week to the next. And I think that's probably going to be generally the case going into these next seasons, because I don't see any club having the facilities or the structure to really change their starting 11 too much going into next season, certainly. So I think next season's going to be a very similar story.
Interesting, isn't it? Because we like a neat story, when we like to summarise things in neat packages, don't we? La Liga is competitive throughout the league, but Real Madrid won it comfortably. The same pockets of teams, as you say, the top 4 still the top four. The little pocket after that, the next three, I think, were the top the three. And then the mid-table teams, effectively the same mid-table teams. So, you know, there is some predictability about it. But so it's quite hard to put your finger on it and come up with a single sentence that says it's brilliantly competitive or it's not. In some ways it is, in some ways it's not. Obviously, Barcelona, you know, that's the arguably the biggest story of the last couple of years, isn't it? Barcelona's financial collapse, is that the word? Because I don't understand Barcelona's finances, because they look to me as if it was disastrous, as if there was a black hole, you know, and they'd never be able to sign a player again. And then every time I go online, you know, they're going to sign Lewandowski or Koundé, or I don't think. I thought they had literally no money left. So the deal is, I'm sure you'll know better, Colin. So the business about them selling their licensing and merchandising rights, or some of it, for the future, a potential sale of future TV rights, is that happening? Is that wise? What are they doing?
Yeah, this is just so incredibly convoluted, isn't it? It's so difficult. If you're not from a financial background, if you're not from this sort of background of economics, it's very difficult to understand this. And I must admit, I struggle quite a bit as well, because a lot of the reporting that you have and a lot of the figures that you see feel entirely contradictory, don't they? When you see the amount of debt that they have, the amount of short-term debt that they have, and you think, right, they're going to need this fire seal, they're going to need to have this 5 or 10 year period of relative austerity. But it's been very different, hasn't it? I mean, they signed four players in the January transfer window. They're talking about signing Lewandowski this season, as you said, Jules Koundé. I think they've already signed, without announcing it, Frank Kessié from Milan, Andreas Christensen from Chelsea as free agents. And they're also linked to Marcus Alonso, to César Azpilicueta. And you sort of think, this is a new team. They signed this entirely new starting 11. And it is perplexing. I think maybe the most simplified way of explaining this is that the club under Joan Laporte, obviously he was the new president from last year, has come in and they have attempted to finance a lot of short-termism to give them space to grow. So essentially they've taken new loans, or they've taken new sources of income which may come back further down the line to cost them more money than they were already in the first place in terms of the debt. However, I think the risk, if you can call it that, which they're taking, is that this has given them the sort of breathing space to grow as a club, or as a brand, as they would maybe talk about. So they would be able to increase their revenue streams in the period of time that they need to repay the loans that they've now taken out again back. And then that would be covered. So it's going to be interesting to see if that pays off, because it's going to be interesting in a number of ways, because a lot of these guys that are responsible for these decisions are not going to be at the club whenever these finances will come back. So they're going to have essentially they're not going to have to deal with any potential mess that is created by this. So that's interesting in one aspect. I mean, it could work. I don't know. I don't have the economic capacity to talk about things like this. But from what I have seen and from what I've read of people who do know, it is dependent on these sorts of markets fluctuating. Like, you know, it just takes one change, and all of a sudden, this has been a disaster. But it's going to be interesting to see, because essentially they're saying, we're going to be able to sign players now, we're going to be able to continue winning trophies. Now, obviously, they haven't really been winning very many trophies recently, but they're going to be investing in this first team squad. And that increases the pressure, I think, as well, on Xavi Hernandez, who it's interesting again, because in many ways, you look at the job he did, he came in, I think, the word ninth, he gets a ninth on the table when Koeman was sacked, and obviously that was quite early, but they finished second, and I think that's really impressive. Yet there were so many disappointments along the way, wasn't there? There was the Europa League elimination, they obviously had the Champions League elimination as well, failing to beat Benfica at home, and then they lost in the Copa, they lost in the Supercopa. There was a lot of disappointing league results, despite that 4-0 win at Real Madrid, and despite that sort of mini run of 2 or 3 months, they had a really good sustained results. There was that fallback again. And you sort of think, and they invested in Ferran Torres, they invested in Aubameyang, you know, they backed him. They're going to do it again. They're going to do that this summer. So there's going to be pressure on Barcelona to close the gap, because how much longer will fans Barcelona, because we're okay with finishing second, finishing third, qualifying for the Champions League, sort of maintaining these income sources, but we're not winning anything. I think there's going to come a point sooner rather than later where that that pressure and expectation will come again, because it is Barcelona. So you know, it's such a period of flux for the club. Yet, you know, I think what they have done is a risk, and it's just going to be one of those things that we're not going to know if it was successful or otherwise for at least we're talking years from now. So it's going to be interesting to see.
I think it's important they did something though, that rather, because I think there's two issues here. What I'm bemused as to how it happened in the first place. I know why it happened. I know the reasons, but nobody noticed it happening at the time, or weren't in a position to stop it happening.
We sort of did, didn't we?
We all kind of thought, are things going the right way at Barcelona? We hear little stories, little snippets here and there, and we kind of assumed that they weren't making a lot of money, and maybe things weren't as good financially because we just read all the little pieces. So I guess Laporta has had to do something. So and mediocre Barcelona are not going to get the profit in the future to get their way out of this problem. So it is, you kind of feel they do have to invest in new players, and primarily at the moment they've got to move on some of those that they haven't been able to move on for 3 years now, that are still on huge salaries, huge wages and whatever. Not playing, you know, Samuel Umtiti in particular, is, I'm not digging him out personally, but he hasn't played for so long. He doesn't even get a game now when there's two or three players injured in his position, and they're going to sign new players in his position as well. It's, you know, I saw Sergio Roberto signed a new one-year extension last week, and Clement Longley is still at the club. There's player Trincao is back again from Wolves this time. So we could do a whole podcast, by the way, and players are suddenly reappearing back at clubs when you thought, Alvaro Morata back at Atletico Madrid. I forgot about that. I saw Lucas Torreira this week, he's going back to Arsenal. And I thought, oh, just when they kind of move these players along, don't they, and think that's the problem dealt with. And then 2 years later, oh, he's back again. We've got to try and move him on. So it just goes to show how incredibly difficult it is to move those players on, to free up the space to bring in the new players that they want to bring in. But something, in my opinion, had to be done at Barcelona. They couldn't be mediocre, because the stadiums won't look attractive. There won't be full up stadiums. They won't be competing. I think they can compete. I'm not suggesting they're going to win trophies again in the next year or two, but I think to compete would be a start. You know, to get to the later stages of the Champions League and stuff like that would be better. But a mediocre Barcelona would just mean that the debt gets worse and worse. Stadium half full capacity, not competing in La Liga, not competing in the Champions League, looking to win the Europa League, which was an ideal. And I agree with Colin, they should have won that this year. And I saw the two teams in the final, I'm thinking, how did Barcelona not get through to this stage at the very least? So they have to spend their way out of trouble a little bit, but it's incredibly tough. I'm glad they're trying to do something as opposed to just moving players on, relying on all the young players, relying on the vets and Piqué and Busquets to combine with Gavi, Pedri, Nico, Balde, all the other young ones. So at least they're trying to do something, but it's so complicated. But my issue is, how did it get to that stage with no one? I guess they weren't allowed. Bartomeu had it sewn up, didn't he? And no one could get in and really give a sort of forensic detailed look at where it was all leading to until it was too late. And he went, and then everybody else is left to clear the mess up.
I think that's a good point though, in terms of like debt in football, especially at these big clubs, these mammoth clubs, has become so normalized to the average person. You know, you see, oh, Man United are in £500 million of debt, Tottenham are in so much debt. And you sort of think, well, that's just been the way it has been for years, and they can still operate normally because they've got their income streams and they've got these long term sort of deals to pay all that off. And that, I think that you see the figures coming out of Boston in years gone by. So you think, oh, well, that's just part of the course, that's just normal. You know, wasn't normal, and until you can really sort of analyze those club accounts, nobody could really come out and say definitively that you're in this much trouble. And it's interesting as well mentioning Umtiti, because he was a player who, of course, hasn't played very much for probably two or three seasons now. Yet he took a pay cut earlier in the season, but to extend his contract. So essentially, he would be getting the same amount of money from the club over a longer period. So that is, again, a case of short-termism, because it's for the here and now, yes, we have saved maybe a couple of thousands a week or whatever it was. Yet we have got this player in our first team squad for an extra year, which means that we cannot change that player for an extra year. So it's that case of you're trying to take this risk of this short-term gamble paying off in the slightly medium to longer term. But Barcelona have so many exciting young players coming through, don't they? I mean, this is the thing. And they're still able to attract so many quality players as free agents. We still have Aubameyang, and this month's going to be Christensen, Frank Kessie. I mean, these are players who are playing at top clubs in Europe. So I don't think it's not going to be this disaster scenario in any case. They're not going to completely fall out of the top three or top four. I mean, that would be a disaster for them. But they've got a very, very competitive squad. It's just a case of whether they can match the expectations that their fans have. Because we've seen the Camp Nou this season. It is half empty. You know, it's half empty for most games. If it's not Real Madrid in town, you know, it just doesn't seem to, whatever it is in terms of ticket price, in terms of maybe the kickoff times, but it's not appealing to their members. And that's a specific club issue as well, because no other club has as many empty seats as Barcelona do. So they have these issues aside from the actual debt itself, in terms of how their club is structured and how it works for their members.
Yeah, I think it's a La Liga problem, that, though, isn't it? I think you're right. I think obviously Barca is the one that really glares out at you, doesn't it? Because you think it should be jam packed, shouldn't it? These people they should be there watching Gavi and Pedri, and you know, even if it's not Messi anymore, it's unbelievable. But I think it's throughout the league you look at it and you think there are too many stadiums with empty seats in them. And I think it's a bit of a lazy answer that you get when you speak to Spanish people about this. They say, oh, it's cultural, just the way it is. It doesn't have to be. It's not that case. You know, look at the prices in Germany compared to Spain. I think I can't remember who it was. Somebody tweeted the price of Alaves, I think, charged Cadiz fans at the end of the season, 150 euros for a ticket, I think it was.
So Alaves and the club had inflated the prices because they knew the Alaves fans weren't going to come. So what they did was that they inflated the price to 140 to 150 euros because they thought, oh, Cadiz fans are just going to flood the stadium. And not only did they increase the prices, but they took the ticket sales offline so you could only buy them at the stadium. And obviously Alaves in the Basque country or the other end of Spain, the Cadiz far. So that would have been impossible for so many fans to go. So yeah, again, it's this sort of structure. I think maybe from La Liga, and La Liga have to look at this and be like, we need these price caps coming in. Because if you don't, I mean, if you and me would go to Spain and think, oh, you know, maybe go to watch Levante or go to watch maybe a mid-ranking La Liga team, you're thinking, oh, it's at least 50 or 60 euros for a ticket. You know, and you go to Germany and it's probably about a quarter of that. And you go to Italy, I went to Verona a couple of months ago to watch a Verona game, and there was tickets for 20 euros and, you know, it was like a prime seat. I just thought, you know, this would not happen in Spain. And I think that's an issue whereby you've got very affordable season tickets, which are fantastic. But what that means is that people can buy a season ticket for maybe 200, 300 euros, whatever it is, and then decide not to go to half the games, which leaves all these seats empty because there's no resale process where you can sell those tickets back to the club and then they sort of redistribute them at reasonable prices. That doesn't happen. So I think we're talking about Barcelona, but this is a wider Spanish problem, a structural problem within the sport that they probably need to modernise that a little bit, because there's nothing worse, certainly from TV point of view, and you're looking at a ground that's half empty.
Yeah,
that's just visually very bad.
Yeah, it doesn't look like it's something that people are keen to watch, does it? That, you know, you've got to give the impression that everybody else is trying desperately to get into that stadium, and then people watch it on TV. I mean, even in the notoriously money grabbing Premier League, there's a £30 away fan price cap on tickets, so that even the Premier League is not doing this. This is you know, very much a La Liga thing, isn't it? Where the match goer, the casual or the away fan, just isn't valued as a concept, as a set of people. Talking of fans, craziness, everything else, Valencia. So you think
thankfully they've got a calm head in now in Gattuso, who's going to calm everything down.
So you think that it's all gone a bit normal there, don't you? You know, borderless. You know, it wasn't necessarily pretty, but it was stable. They got to the cup final. I thought with the resources available to him, it was about as good a solid mid-table finish as you're going to get. But no, it wasn't good enough. So Gattuso is coming in. Is this going to be accompanied by renewed interest from the owners? Then it would work, potentially, if they're going to start chucking 30 million at players and 50 million at players again. Or are they thinking that somehow Gattuso is going to work some magic?
The Gattuso appointment is really interesting. Last year, of course, Gattuso was appointed at Fiorentina, and then his appointment was cancelled at Fiorentina 2 weeks later. So we never actually managed the club, even though we had that contract in place. And that was allegedly because of a falling out between Gattuso or Gattuso's representative, who is obviously very well known as George Mendes, and the Fiorentina board. And there's essentially a clash on the transfer strategy, whereby certainly Fiorentina as a club saying, you know, you just want to bring in Mendes clients, but we have a different strategy, we have a different approach. So their relationship broke down. And also you had the issues with the Tottenham links. Tottenham were on the verge of appointing, obviously Tottenham had that ridiculous manager search last summer. Tottenham were on the verge of appointing him, and then the old comments from Gattuso emerged, which many people deemed to be very much out of touch and out of place in modern society with regards to the women in football and everything else, all these other societal issues. And Tottenham fans essentially launched a campaign against the club not to appoint him. So the club relented and they didn't appoint him. And he's been out of football for a year. And now he's rocked up in Valencia. And yeah, as Terry alluded to, there is this, he is the personality of Gattuso, it's like he was as a player, isn't he? He's like a very combative, almost like he's as a for opponents, very irritating, very much in your face sort of guy. And listen, his managerial record's okay, isn't it? He's managed at Milan, he's managed at Napoli, and I think both of those stints were generally seem to be fine. Not spectacular, but fine. But the issue with Valencia here is we're talking about George Mendes, and that's been a long-term criticism of the club, that it's fine to have these relationships, but whenever that relationship with the agent sort of supersedes the club's ambitions and what the club's strategy is, that becomes problematic. So Are Valencia just going to be signing players from a particular agent? Are they going to be signing players who that agent wants to have at that club? Or are they going to be signing players because they need those players, because they want those players in position for whatever sort of vision they have as a club? So that's going to be interesting to see. But listen, Valencia, I mean, Anil Murthy left the club over the comments that were leaked to the Spanish press, which, I mean, listen, you hear the comments and they're not good. But at the same time, the fact that Peter Lim, or it seems that Peter Lim has taken this decision to get rid of this guy because it was, from a PR point of view, a bit of a disaster. Maybe that is actually a good thing, that he has now recognised the fact that fans were so unhappy with the situation and the media clearly weren't happy with it either. That, you know, we want to repair these relationships, we want to build these bridges again. So maybe that's actually a positive step, but it's very early to tell. And if they're going to sell off the top players again, Carlos Soler has been linked away. Gonzalo Guedes has been linked away. I think the key one is Gaia, isn't it, the left back? In terms of the fans, because he's like seen as this sort of symbol of what Valencia is. And so it's going to be like, no, we're going to cash in on you. And it's not just the fact that they're cashing in on these players, they're selling them to their direct rivals. Remember when they sold Parejo and Capoue to Villarreal? So you're right, here are our local rivals, here's a new midfield. It's going to propel you to European success. And not only that, but we're giving you away for peanuts. Essentially, we're not getting good deals. Even Ferran Torres left the city. It was only €20 million. You know, it was an absolute bargain. So Valencia are a bit of a basket case at the minute. We said earlier, they reached the Copa del Rey final. And I was at that match. I covered it. And their fans were incredible. You know what I mean? They have such a... I mean, that club has the potential to be easily a top four club in Spain. They should be Champions League regulars. We're talking about them being like, oh, the table's an okay finish for them. I mean, that is the sort of paradox that we've got. The board last did do an okay job. He got to the final. He respectable enough league finish. They have good players there. But you just think the way that institutionally, the way it's run, just isn't good enough. And the divide between the fans and the ownership needs to change, and it needs to change quickly.
Do you think Gattuso makes the start of the season? Because we've got that we've got the transfer window to get through. If something doesn't go his way, I can see a trouble brewing. I really can. I think it's going to, I hope he does, and I hope we see the adventure that holds with Gattuso and Valencia on the pitch, off the pitch. He's a passionate guy. He's not going to be dull. He's seen some of his press conferences. He's clearly going to be something of interest to watch this season, but it's going to be volatile, and he doesn't suffer fools gladly. I'm pretty sure the Valencia owners don't. But I agree with Colin. Gaia and Soler in particular, the two young players that come through the Valencia system, they are flag bearers for the club, for the supporters. There will be a time, you know, when those two, I think Soler is probably already there, and maybe Gaia, where they do feel that their career is going to be best served elsewhere because of they're running out of patience. So I think, you know, they'll give it a go with Gattuso. They're going to hope in the summer. I would imagine, like the Valencia supporters, that this is going to be the summer of change and they are going to start spending money, investing money in players. I'm not convinced there's going to be a massive, drastic change at Valencia in terms of their investment in new players this summer. So Bordalás improved on Javi Gracia the year before in terms of league positioning. I don't know what else was expected of him. You know, they were close to winning the Copa del Rey final. I know that the style of play wasn't to what a lot of Valencia supporters want to see, but at least their team were competitive and improved on the year before. So it's going to be interesting to watch Gattuso at Valencia, that's for sure.
And obviously, Colin, while you're here, I'll plug your book again, so the Frying Pan of Spain. So there's, you know, there's your old stomping ground in Seville. So, I mean, good. I thought Betis, a lovely team to watch, terrific season. Sevilla, now where they finished in the end was, you know, at the start of the season, we did this predictions league and people, I think people said fourth. So it's just feels like a bit of a missed opportunity. And then as Terry and I say, you know, we agree on this, they're pretty dull to watch Sevilla as well, aren't they? It just feels like a missed opportunity for them. But at the same time, I don't want to be too critical because it's all right, isn't it? It's not a disaster.
Yeah, and the sale by Barcelona Athletic will finish second and third. And you look at that in isolation and be like, oh, look, that's okay. But because we're saying that in the sense that had they started the season so strongly and then tailed off near the end, we would have been thinking, oh, no, this is actually a bad outcome. But because it was normalised for us so early, it sort of feels like, oh, that was sort of the normal thing. You know, they just had a bad start and never really recovered. Sevilla were in the title race in January. They did not sell players this summer or in January, last summer and this January, because they thought we have a team who are capable of challenging for titles. They signed Anthony Martial on a loan deal on for what Sevilla terms were big wages and got no return from that whatsoever. They signed Tasquito Corona as well. And they invested in their squad and they had a deep squad. And yes, there were injuries and yes, there were mitigating factors, but Sevilla should have done better than they did this season. And yes, they finished fourth, which we think that's par. But had they have fallen out of that top four, and especially had Betis been the club to replace them in that top four, then there would have been no chance whatsoever that there would not have been massive changes this summer, not just in terms of the manager, but in terms of the playing staff, maybe in terms of deeper within the club too. And this is the thing with Lopetegui, because there is no doubt he has done a good job, in fact, a very good job. You know, three top four finishes in a row, winning the Europa League, seeing that real progress. And we know from his days at Spain and then previously as well, he knows how to really get the best out of some players, to really make a team that works, a system that works. But whenever that system stops working, there's very little by when individuality becomes out of that. So players, if one thing fails, the whole thing tends to sort of become a bit steel. And that's definitely happened, certainly in the second half of the season. Look at the number of matches they drew. They only lost four games in La Liga. They finished fourth. They could easily finish lower. They just drew far, far too many matches. And the style of play was dull. It wasn't exciting. And from a Sevilla point of view, they obviously clinched top four with, I think it was the penultimate game week. And the talks, I had this story, I broke the story first, that Sevilla and Lopetegui were going to have a conversation after the season ended, which they have had, and which there was no definitive outcome either way, certainly initially. And again, Jorge Mendes, who we speak about a lot, came into Seville, and that was one of the things that he was discussing, was the management position, and was in terms of the club and how their outlook would be for next season, because Lopetegui's been there for 3 years. 3 years is a long time for any one manager. There's been, in my eyes, there's been a downturn in the past 6 months, not just in terms of performance, but the results as well. And the players don't seem to be responding positively to those changes. We've seen that Diego Carlos has already been sold. Jules Koundé is very, very, very likely to follow. Whether they can replace those players with similar calibers, it's yet to be seen. But they spent more than they wanted to spend in the past 12, 18 months. Under the sort of belief that they could challenge these titles more than they did. So they're now in a position where they have to scale back a little bit. So it's going to be interesting to see what they do, because Julen Lopetegui, it looks at this point like he will stay at the club, but are players going to still be responsive to him? And as soon as things start to go wrong next season at any point, fans will turn against him quite quickly because they already have, in a way, turned against him. Now, there's not a sense that he's been a failure, but they turned against him in the sense that things aren't working anymore, that things aren't, he's not playing, he's not having his teams play in the way that the Sevilla fans feel like Sevilla teams should play. You know, the sort of intense, direct style. They've sort of lost that. They've become very, very slow and passive in the build-up, but a lot of teams just sort of set up quite well against him. You see that just by the number of draws. They've had the 0-0s and 1-1s, especially against teams in the lower half of the league. So there's these issues that are going to go in the next campaign. I think the only way around this is by signing and signing well this summer, and we know that Monchi is very, very good at that. But again, Monchi is somebody who's maybe had a little bit of criticism in the past year or two for the players he's brought in. I mean, that Anthony Martial deal. I mean, at the time, you kind of think it was quite an exciting addition for Sevilla. From somebody who's watched Man United quite a bit as well, stylistically, just does not fit into what Sevilla wanted to do. And it was almost like that was a sign in that was, you know, this is great for us as a club, as a brand, to be like, oh, Anthony Martial, this big name is joining us and people are going to be interested in us now who might not naturally be. It just didn't work at all. So this is a huge summer for the club, for Lopetegui, for the players. I mean, if they were to finish fourth again next season, you have to come back and say, yeah, that is good, that's par. But yeah, you feel like there should be, and there certainly could be more.
Terry, Monchi's got to keep on top of this, hasn't he? He was revolutionary, wasn't he, with the amount of detail they put into their transfer work. They were ahead of their time, weren't they? The whole, you know, scouring across. There's interesting stuff on YouTube that we discussed before where, you know, they do this sort of big sweep across and then they do a narrowed down version, looking at a load of players, doing a load of research, keeping on top of it. With the increase of football intelligence, so, you know, data analysis and all that, other clubs are doing that as well. So in a sense, you know, that they've got to...
It's getting harder.
Yeah, it's getting harder, isn't it, for you to be the ones that is always finding the bargain. And so they've got to find a way of keeping on top, keeping that advantage going, haven't they, Sevilla? And which brings you back to this sense that this was a missed opportunity this season.
Yeah, I agree. It's totally a missed opportunity because of the seasons that Atletico and Barca had, then Sevilla should clearly have finished in second place and they should have been closer to Real Madrid. So I think it is going to be interesting. They're clearly going to have to scale down. They were grateful in the end to finish in the top four because of Champions League football. That had been another massive, huge blow to their finances. So it is going to be interesting. I am already looking at who they're linked with and trying to, you know, I didn't know much about Koundé and Diego Carlos before they came to Sevilla, and clearly that's worked for them. The fact they didn't sell them suggests that they believe they could challenge seriously for the title. And maybe they had a bit of foresight and sort of maybe Barcelona in particular were going to go through a difficult patch. I don't think anyone recognised there might be some issues at Atletico in terms of how poor they were this season. But Sevilla and Monchi and the people that run the club must have thought, you know, we really could go close. And ultimately, in the end, they didn't. The criticism is of the style of play from Lopetegui. It doesn't fit with your classic Sevilla style. So he had to win. He had to finish in a really impressive manner in the season. They didn't. So then people look at the style and say, well, we're finishing where we'd finished before. We haven't won the UEFA Cup, the Europa League, which we normally do. We were in the Champions League. We fell out of that in the group without really putting up a fight. It wasn't a tough group. And then they fall out of the Europa League. They lost to Betis in the Copa del Rey and they just about scrambled over the line in fourth place. So it is going to be interesting. You know, it's a shame to see. But it's what Sevilla do. It's their business model. It's made them successful over a period of time. Buying players cheap-ish, selling them for huge profits, and then finding replacements and doing it, repeating it over and over again. So it's going to be hard. I think in Monchi, though, they do have someone. All clubs have data analysis and they have everything covered. But I think he does give you that something extra where he actually isn't just looking at data and computers and laptops. He actually, him and his group, they know the players. They've watched the players. So they will use the data to help them, but I can promise you, if this there will still do it. Don't ask me how they do it, but these methods of buying players for the future, for now, we watch these stuff on YouTube, but they actually buy like Tecatito, Papa Gomez. They're for now, Rakitic there for now, but then they buy players based on like Koundé and Carlos and, you know, Cunha, Montiel, players that they can make money on. So it's going to be interesting to see who they come up with replacements for Carlos, Diego Carlos, and maybe Koundé.
Just quickly, John, just to follow up on that, the point about Monchi is interesting because Monchi is essentially why Sevilla are where they are now, and it's essentially why we're seeing talking about a fourth place finish for Sevilla being a little bit disappointing. It shows you where the club are. It's because of him. It's similar to Atletico Madrid and this argument with Diego Simeone. It's like, well, they've underachieved this season, that's true, and especially comparative to their resources, but the reason they have their resources and the reason they have those expectations is because of Simeone. The same with Sevilla and Monchi. You've got these characters who've essentially propelled these clubs to the position they are now, and they allow them to be so profitable and to be so well-run and to have the expectations that they do. Yeah, the problem, especially with Sevilla and Lopetegui, is you talk about going out to Champions League group stages. Can they really push on? Can they push on from this point? Can they be at the point where they've got the budget that they do have, but they continue signing so well at that level? Because the bigger your budget, same when Monchi went to Roma, I've got this huge budget several times what it was with Sevilla, but that almost makes it difficult because clubs know that you've got that money, and it means that you're looking at a different market for players as well, because you've got to be signing players who are more ready-made for the first team and who aren't just being made sort of for profit several years down the line, but are being made for the here and now to improve your team. And that's a new, different challenge. And that's similar to, I think, what Simeone has at Atletico, whereby you have this huge increased budget from what he had at the start. You know, you're signing players who should be elevating you to the likes of Real Madrid and Barcelona. Yeah, the style of play didn't necessarily evolve with that. That sounds like a criticism. It's not. It's just what made them so successful to get into the level they are. It's like they now need to find something, almost to reinvent themselves again to move to the next level. So that's, I think that's the sort of interesting parallel of just can those clubs not just sustain where they are, but they actually push on to the very sort of top step. And I think that's the question that faces both clubs in the next few years.
And the exciting part is if Betis invest in the right way, which they've been doing for a few years now, then that gap was close this year. It's going to be even closer, and the rivalry between those two teams in the same city is going to be something to look forward to next year, in the next few weeks when we start again.
So the question I was going to ask was about Atleti, actually. So you sort of took us there anyway, Colin, which was, so if Morata is going back, you know, spin the Morata wheel, don't you? And he either ends up at Juve, Real Madrid, Chelsea or Atletico when the season starts. Are they where they were again last season? Because I thought they were top heavy last season. I thought in terms of personnel, they struggled as soon as they had a couple of injuries in the back. Once Trippier had gone, didn't help with the chopping and changing of the formation, which he never seemed to find the solution. And then I just thought literally too many bodies up front at times. So question for you both, really. Are you confident that Simeone can solve that? That they will be better this season. I mean, the concept of reversion to the norm suggests they should be. They shouldn't lose those games against the teams at the bottom that they lost this season, should they? So they should do better. You would expect them to normally do better. Are they going to do enough better to be going for the title again?
There's an interesting argument that because they were champions, it actually took away a lot of the edge that made them champions in the first place. Now, this is an interesting sort of way of looking at it, I think. But in terms of going beyond the tactics and the personnel, just the fact that they'd won the league, they'd really, you know, they'd that sort of pinnacle, and then you go into the next season, and that there was something about it. And I know that they won the league with Yano Black being incredible because of Luis Suarez being incredible, and that was those two factors in themselves were both unsustainable, and those drop offs were so significant in terms of what they could do. But I think in general that there was just a sense that there was a drop-off in those energy levels and the sort of the huge intensity and focus that comes from Simeone's teams. And even in the Champions League, against that tie against Man City was so interesting because, you know, everybody sort of like, critical, you know, you don't attack. And well, it's like, well, actually, that game went down to the final 10 or 15 minutes of the second leg. And it really looked, watching that, like Atletico Madrid, we want to get that goal. You know, and they were sort of all over City. City were a bit rattled. And then you had this thing where Atletico actually were the team that almost lost their heads in the final few minutes. When was it? Was it wasn't Phil Foden who sort of rolled back onto the pitch injured, and Felipe and Savage just completely lost it. And I say that is exactly the opposite of what we imagine these Simeone sides to be like. These are supposed to be the guys who can handle these situations, and they're supposed to rile up the opposition. But even though the sort of British TV coverage of it was incredibly skewed, I actually thought that it was City who sort of had the dark arts in that game, who perfected them. And Atletico, it was strange that they just seemed to react so badly to it. And it was almost like this sense of just frustration of the season they'd had, and sort of like that loss of sort of focus and exactly what their goal was. So, yeah, I think a lot of it was psychological. But yeah, you look at the personnel as well, and the injuries they had defensively, the structure defensively, they just conceded goals far too easily. Jan Oblak had probably the worst season I have ever seen from him, and by a long way. And they just couldn't replace the goals from Suarez. And obviously Suarez looks to be leaving this summer, so maybe that'll give them the chance to incorporate that new striker, whether it's Morata or somebody else. But it's going to be interesting because I think they need to refine their identity, I suppose. And it's just going to be interesting to see what sort of combination Simeone uses to do that.
No, I agree. I think that Simeone made a really good interview at the end of the season where he took the blame, and he claims he knows exactly what he did wrong. And he kind of alluded to the fact that too many changes, tactical changes, personnel changes. So maybe a scaled down squad would make his life easier. When they've had success, they've predominantly played a lot of the time a consistent starting 11, a consistent style. It wasn't just the attacking players, it was the midfield players. They've got an abundance of really good players, which led us all to believe that because of the strength of their squad, they should challenge again. And I actually made them favourites at the start of the season. I thought they were in really good shape. The signing of Rodrigo de Paul was good. Cunha coming in has been a good signing. So I don't think they clearly need Morata back, but he's back. Saul is coming back as well. So there's some player issues there they've got to deal with. And I think for the first time, Simeone was a little bit confused because of having so many players to who to pick, to who to be fair upon, to rotate more than he's ever done before. To the extent when Atletico played a game, you really wasn't sure what their midfield lineup was going to be. You're never sure who was going to play up front, what shape they were going to play. And then he consistently changed shapes throughout the game. So I do really believe next year they're going to regain that identity that they had, which is solidity at the back. Defensively minded is the first issue. And they do have the quality in attack. They're not going to be a team that are going to blow teams away and score loads of goals, but they will be a team. They need to be a team that win games 1-0 again. And they weren't that, like, they were far from that last season. Didn't Oblak let in more goals than ever before with 14 league games to go? Or yeah. Simeone, more goals. Simeone conceded more goals in a season with something like 14 league games to go. That tells you everything you need to know about Atletico.
And Oblak's personal stats were bad as well. It wasn't just a structural thing, you know, from this guy having been such an asset in previous seasons, having, you know, outperformed the level of Atleti's defence and rescued them with amazing saves that were pivotal in games, to last season just not being that was quite a shift. Last question then for both of you. Real Madrid stronger than they were last season, which will be a worrying sign for everybody else. How big a loss was Mbappe, or was it not? Is it the best thing that he stayed at PSG, given that, you know, he's now the manager of the club and he's being paid £1 billion a week?
The manager already.
Mbappe. I mean, how do you on the other side of Mbappe? You're talking. He's just one of those players who guarantees excellence, doesn't he? I mean, that's what you're talking about. But when you look at the Real Madrid side and where they actually needed to strengthen or improve, it probably was signing Antonio Rudiger or the Matteo Tchouaméni from Monaco. I mean, he's a fantastic player. I haven't seen him too much, but I've seen him before maybe 4 or 5 times for Monaco and a couple of times for France. And he's just such a he's one of those sort of modern midfielders. It's just a total package, a little bit like Jude Bellingham. At Borussia Dortmund, you know, these young guys who sort of aren't just these sort of defensive holding midfielders, but they're sort of almost like box to box. They can tackle, they can run, they can create chances and everything else. So that's going to be interesting to see. Is Toni Kroos going to be the one who's phased out? Is Luka Modric going to be phased out? Because obviously they've got Camavinga to step up as well. And they've got, so if you're looking at Camavinga and Tchouaméni in this sort of long-term midfield, I think that's as exciting as Pedri, Gavi for Barcelona. And Mbappe is obviously someone that they had planned around a lot, but at the same time, the wages that would have been involved in that deal, the signing on fees, the agent fees, and everything else would have been astronomical. But now they can invest that, and they have been investing it in other parts of the squad. It'll be interesting to see if they do sign that one more attacking player. I don't think it'll be a starting attacking player, but I've seen them with Gabriel Jesus. Somebody like that, who will be a bit more industrious, who won't exactly be the sort of central figurehead who's expected to get 20 or 30 goals a year, but who can chip in, who can play sort of various positions in that attack. I think maybe that would give them the complete squad that they want. But I think that the way they've managed this transition is just so good, whereby you've got players like Camavinga, like, you know, who is undoubtedly this excellent, incredibly exciting young player who's just being phased in so gradually. He's not expected to come in and be a starter, whereas he probably would be had he gone to any other top club. And it gives him that chance to embed in the culture of the club and everything else. And that is something that Real Madrid are very good at. Can they sustain what they did this year? It's hard to say. Is Benzema going to sustain his form? Probably not. Is he going to get injured? Very possibly. I mean, remember the season before last, whereby they had so many injuries that they only had, 10, 11 senior outfield players who were fit going into the final couple of months of the campaign. They were really decimated by some muscular injuries, and they didn't have any of those essentially this season. They kept that starting 11 almost fit for every single game week. That almost certainly won't happen again next year. So are we going to see a bit of a drop off on that front? I think probably. We probably will. We'll probably see at least a closer title race. I still would have them as favourites because of the players that they have. In fact, that every other top team is in some element of transition, whereby they're not. But I still think there'll be a little bit of a drop off, and the expectations as well haven't come off that high of the title, the Champions League victory, which is probably the most remarkable Champions League victory I can remember of any club. That there's bound to be a bit of a come down from that. And it'll be interesting as well, because there will be questions on Ancelotti's future too, because he's essentially achieved something that, you know, he never expected to go back to Real Madrid in the first place. He then went back and has achieved these remarkable feats. Like, how can he possibly better that? You know, is he somebody that's really got the sort of the motivation to stick around for too long as well? Are Real Madrid going to look to maybe replace him with somebody somebody who can actually maybe change the style of play a bit and evolve them a little bit in the year or two to come? That's going to be interesting. I think they're favourites for the title at this very early stage, but I don't see them running away with it in a similar vein.
Yeah, I think it would have been fun to have seen Mbappe, clearly. I mean, there's no doubt in his quality and the excitement he would have brought to La Liga and to Real Madrid, but I think they're in pretty good shape. I mean, Rodrigo is a player that's on the up as well, and can't underestimate how important he was in the second half of the season, particularly in the Champions League. But the promise is there. We've seen the improvement of Vinicius, drastic improvement in 1 year. Rodrigo could do that next season. He could be a player that we're talking about that's got 17, 18, 20 goals for Real Madrid. Eden Hazard, I like the noises coming out from Eden Hazard. It clearly looks like he's had an issue that's been bugging him in terms of his injury that's causing him problems from all his time. There was a possibility he could leave, but he's made it clear he wants to show finally, Real Madrid, the supporters, the true Hazard. Perhaps he feels with this having the latest bout surgery on his ankle is going to put him back into top shape. So I think there are one or two issues. We shouldn't forget Fede Valverde, how he's progressed as well. Arguably man of the match in the Champions League final, in my opinion. And then the only position I think they need to address is the right back. Because when Dani Carvajal has been injured, it's all well and good putting in players. Valverde's played there, Lucas Vasquez has played there, and there's another one of those players that's coming back on loan. Odriozola is coming back to Real Madrid. So I think they do need another really good right back rather than filling, you know, square pegs in round holes. Marcelo's left the club, left back. I mean, I know they've got Nacho, but Alaba can play left back, so he fulfills that role. He can play centre back, left back, holding midfield. So it's I think right back is the only position they do need to look at now to get top class cover or competition for Dani Carvajal. And apart from that, they're in fantastic shape.
Old man observation, Terry, from what Colin said about midfielders who can defend and attack and get up and down the pitch. I was, all right, so we'll come back to that, have we? So, you know, it's like...
Oh, the other one I was going to say was Gabriel Jesus. Be an ideal signing for Real Madrid because he can play wide, he can play up the middle. If that means then that Diaz, Mariano Diaz and Luka Jovic are not sacrificed, but are sold and made way for Gabriel Jesus, because you wouldn't want to be Gabriel Jesus going there, or you wouldn't want to be a striker going there and being in the same position as Diaz and Jovic, where Benzema plays, you're not going to play. And you can lose a season, you can lose two seasons. Mariano Diaz has lost three seasons, probably. So someone that can play that role up front, or someone can play wide as well. So Gabriel Jesus wouldn't go there. Ideally, as only backup, he will be able to play on the right side of attack. He can play up front. So I think that would make really good sense for Real Madrid.
One season going to Real Madrid, whoever you are, makes sense. Sitting, playing half a dozen games a season, or of that three games a season or something, season after season after season, there comes a point at which your dignity has got to kick in, hasn't it? And say, I want to play football.
Yes, isn't that sort of the case with Dani Ceballos? I mean, coming on and he was key Champions League, isn't he? Dani Ceballos, like somebody who was such a huge, exciting prospect. Better, so he had that low spell at Arsenal, and then, you know, and then sort of coming on. And I actually think he made a difference when he came on in the Champions League. He gave that little bit of energy in midfield, and he really exploded the. Yeah, I thought Real Madrid actually managed the last sort of 10 or 15 minutes of that final so well, because they created opportunities for themselves, even though they didn't have any shots on goal. They created those chances in the way, I think the way Ancelotti managed it was quite clever. And I think Ceballos might be one of those players who does leave Madrid this summer. Again, I think Betis have been sort of evaluating the opportunity to make him return, and he's very much keen for that. It's just a question of finances. So Real Madrid, I think, I agree with Terry, it's the right back position, isn't it? Even left back in terms of the Fernand Mendy, who I quite like, but again, you sort of think with Marcelo gone, maybe cover for that would probably be wise as well. But you just look at the squad of players that they have, and it's enviable for everyone else, isn't it?
Yes. Colin, it's been lovely talking to you. Good to catch up as well. Thank you for coming on. So Colin's stuff you can find at The Mirror, and he's on Twitter as well. And his book is The Frying Pan of Spain, which is from Pitch Publishing. So lovely to talk to you. Terry, we'll catch up again soon and start looking ahead to the start of the season. And who knows, but there's the whole presidential election going on at Athletic. So there's plenty of stuff to talk about as well before the start of the season. And eventually we'll know who is in La Liga for next season as well, which will be nice as well. So if you're not a Patreon, patreon.com/LTEL, and it would be good to have you there. And we'll see you for another podcast soon. And Colin, lovely to see you. And we will try and catch up again another time.